My name is Dave Spillman. I'm a retired captain from the Coast Guard, and I went to the Coast Guard Academy, graduated in 1979, and then I went to the Coast Guard Cutter Dependable in Panama City, Florida for about a year. Then I went to flight school. I graduated from there in, I think it was October of 1981. Transitioned to the H-52. I went to Savannah for my first air station. I flew the H-52 and then on to Corpus Christi, and I think 1985, I flew the H-52 there for about a year and then transitioned to the H-65. In 1988, I went up to Air Station Houston, transitioned back into the H-52. I think I did the last H-52 transition course. And then like 6 months or so after that, transitioned back into the H-65 again. Then I went to graduate school. I was an aeronautical engineer, so I went to graduate school at Purdue. And then I went to the Coast Guard Research and Development Center, where I worked on aviation projects for 3 or 4 years. After that, I went to Air Station Kodiak, where I was the EO, and then I became the XO. And from there, Air Station Detroit, where I was the CO. And then my last tour, I was the Chief of Search and Rescue in the 1st Coast Guard District in Boston, and I retired in 2006. So it was a long, great career. We had a fabulous time. My wife and I met my wife, my first air station in Savannah. Charlie Ray, the Vice Admiral Charlie Ray, the current Ancient Albatross, introduced me to her. He was a Lieutenant JG and I was a Lieutenant. And we got married in Corpus Christi and been together now for 30 years. So stories, I had one. So I got a Distinguished Flying Cross. I thought I'd tell that story. When I was in Houston, that would have been in 1989. It was early August in 1989. And I had the duty. I came in at 3 o'clock. We were leaving in the afternoon. And there was a hurricane had just kind of sprung up in the Gulf, Hurricane Chantel. It's a category one, you know, small hurricane. So that was probably around 4 o'clock. They notified us that in 48 hours or something, they thought the hurricane was going to affect Houston. So we started making preparations to evacuate, hurricane evacuation, the helicopters. We were going to go to San Antonio, I think. So we started, we had, I think only one of our four helicopters was flyable. So I was the engineering officer, and my maintenance guys started working pretty hard to put everything back together and get everything cleaned up as well as we could. And then, so that lasted most of the afternoon, and I flew a couple of test flights, and we had eventually three out of the four up, and the fourth one was not going to be flyable. It was hard down. Just before we went to bed, I think we got launched out for a case in Galveston. The wind was just starting to pick up a little bit then. So we hoisted two guys off the jetties in Galveston and brought them to the airport at Galveston and came back home, went to bed probably around 11:30 or midnight or something like that. And then during the night, the hurricane accelerated very quickly. And so we were awakened at, I think, about 4 a.m. The station at Sabine, Texas, which is right on the Texas-Louisiana border, called us to say that a shrimp boat had capsized on the edge of the jetty, which sticks out about probably a mile and a half into the Gulf of Mexico from Sabine, from the Sabine River. And their 41-footer had been out there to try to evacuate them. They couldn't get to them because it was probably 30 feet of surf or something like that breaking over the top of the capsized boat. So he said, I remember he said, "Can you fly?" And I said, "Oh, I don't know. I mean, I just woke up. I can hear it's raining. That's about all I know. So let me check the weather, and we'll get back to you in a little bit." So I went and looked at the weather, and the weather was pretty crummy. As you can imagine, the hurricane was just about to come ashore on the, so the eye was just a little bit south of the coastline. And talked to the captain. We had only transitioned to the 865 maybe 6 months before that or something like that. I was the one of the most experienced aircraft commanders because I had flown it at my previous air station. And we only had really one other aircraft commander that was very experienced in the aircraft at all. So I called him. He was our ops officer, Dana Goward. And I talked to him, and I talked to our CEO, Captain Ted White, who had just relieved, you know, like 6 weeks before or something like that. And I told him I thought I could make it. And so they sort of reluctantly agreed to let us fly. I called the FAA for a weather briefing. And I remember I laughed at the end. So he gave it the whole weather briefing, of, you know, 100-foot overcast and quarter-mile visibility, heavy winds, embedded thunderstorms, embedded tornadoes. His last sentence was, VFR flight not recommended. So I said to him, oh, okay, so what, do you think I should go into the clouds? And he laughed and he said, no, I'm just reading the script. So we took off. We flew from Houston. That was probably, it might have been 200-foot overcast and maybe a half a mile visibility or something. I remember on the way out, we flew down Space Center Boulevard. I had to go around the water tower on the Johnson Space Center because the cloud deck was down below that. And as we went over, my house was like a block south of the flight path, and my wife was up feeding our then 6-month-old baby, my son Steve, who's 27 now, you know, but she heard the helicopter go over and couldn't believe that we were flying. So she couldn't even bring herself to call the station. She called a friend of ours to say, was that the helicopter I just heard go over? And he called the station for her and called her back and said, yeah, they went. So I remember she told me that she paced for like 2 hours waiting to hear the helicopter come back over. So it was... So Mike Couch was my co-pilot, and John Romano, we call the cheese dog, was the flight mechanic. We didn't have rescue swimmers in those days. And we flew out over, I remember we went by, again, after we went around the water tower, we went past the, I think it was a Hilton Hotel on the shoreline of Clear Lake, that we went by at maybe like the fifth or sixth floor level. And then out over Galveston Bay. And once we got over Galveston Bay, it got really dark. So we had a hard time finding our way. We got a little confused over Galveston Bay for a while and figured out finally we were going further up the bay instead of towards Sabine. So we set ourselves a waypoint and started flying toward that. We got over the beach. On the coastline of Texas, the Gulf of Mexico, and the wind was blowing about probably maybe 60 or 70 knots, and we were crabbed into it pretty severely, so we were pointing about probably 40 degrees offshore, although we were following the coastline, and Mike Houts and I were sharing the controls. Whichever one of us could see would fly the cyclic, and so that was him most of the first part because he was on the left side and he could see the shoreline, and whichever one of us didn't have the cyclic would control the collective to try to hold altitude and keep us at some semblance of airspeed. It was a pretty severe turbulence. So the hurricane, actually we went through the eye of the hurricane just around High Island, Texas, and we punched through the wall of clouds, and just like they say, I mean, it was clear blue skies above us and calm winds, and everything was great for about 2 miles, and then we punched back in on the other side, and then we had to, of course, we were on the other side of the hurricane. The crab angle changed about 40 degrees the other way, and so then I started flying the cyclic, and Mike Houts started flying the collective. We got to the Sabine. We followed the jetty all the way out, in the shrimp boat was laying on its starboard side, right on the very tip of the jetty, with a port outriggers sticking straight up in the air about maybe 30 feet or so, and there were five guys hanging on the gunwale with about, you know, 30 feet of surf or something breaking over them every once a minute or something. And I just couldn't believe that they were still able to hang on. So we got in a hover. We had about, we had between 60 and 70 knots of wind in the hover probably. So it didn't take very much power to hover, fortunately. I told John to, you know, go on hot mic, and we did the rescue brief and everything. And so he conned me up to the point where the only thing I could see was the tip of the outrigger, and pretty much I was just flying formation on that. He had a bunch of extra weight bags on the basket to try to keep it hanging straight down, but even so, it was blowing, you know, 30 or 40 feet behind the airplane probably, so he had to con us way forward to get it there. So he got the basket somehow down by him, and three of them jumped in. So he said, I remember him saying, there's three of them. And I said, well, do you think they weigh more than 600 pounds? And he said, no, no, they're little Vietnamese guys. I said, all right, well, bring them up. So I could feel a pretty good list when he took the load. But, you know, a basket came up fine. As it came up to the door, I remember hearing him yell, stay in the basket, stay in the basket. You know, they were trying to jump out. And they were pretty crowded in the basket, too. So then as he pulled the basket, and my couch was kind of leaning across the center console and in the back helping him get it in and, you know, get people positioned and everything. And then we put the basket back down. Must have been six people, because I remember we made two hoists, six people. There were three people in the basket each time. Then we had them all on board. We took off from there and went back. There's a little landing strip right at the base of the jetty, basically, and Station Sabine is right behind there. So we landed on the runway, and the guys didn't want to get out because two of their shipmates were still missing, had been washed over, and they wanted to help us search for those other two guys. And so we're trying to, you know, there's a pretty significant language barrier. They were Vietnamese. They didn't speak very good English. They were really worried about their shipmates. They didn't want to get out at all. The station was there to pick them up, but so we spent only maybe 2 or 3 minutes trying to convince them to leave. And fortunately for us, so another helicopter had taken off from Houston about maybe 45 minutes behind us or something like that. The ops officer, Dana Goward, and Pat McHugh had come in to fly that, and I think Tony Johnson was their flight mechanic. And so then, by the grace of God, they found the two guys in the water and picked them up just about that time. So we were able to tell them, no, it's okay. The other helicopter has your buddies, and they have finally agreed to get out. So then we had to get back to the air station. We were on the wrong side of the hurricane, we thought. So we were on the right-hand side, which we thought would be the worst side. So we decided to go kind of behind it. I had moved farther ashore, and it was not an easy flight back. Same, you know, pretty much the same conditions. It was probably 200 over and half a mile to a quarter mile vis most of the way back, and 60 to 75 knots of wind most of the way. But we made it back, and we landed, and everybody was fine. And then the two crews, our crew and Dana Goward's crew, both were named as the Helicopter Association International, the HAI Humanitarian Service Award for that year. So I got a DFC. Everybody in my crew got an air medal. And one of the most rewarding rescues of my whole career. So thanks. That was a unique time in my life. So then I want to tell another story about, this is when I was in Houston also. It wasn't a rescue story, but the mega tanker, Mega Borg, caught on fire and was dumping oil about probably 75 miles offshore from Houston or something like that. So this tanker was in the lightering area offshore where they would transfer. They were too big to come into the port of Houston, so they would transfer their oil to lightering barges, and then they'd shuttle it in. And one of the pumps caught on fire and started a big leak, and the ship was on fire, and oil was flowing into the Gulf of Mexico. I can't remember if millions of barrels of oil were leaked into the Gulf of Mexico, and the tanker burned for, I want to say, like 8 or 10 days, and the oil was leaking for probably 2 weeks or something like that. So I got called in. Actually, I was the second crew. I didn't have the duty that night, so I got called in probably around 6 o'clock in the morning, I think, and it was a Saturday morning, and we launched out, and you could see the column of smoke rising as soon as we left the ground at Houston. So we followed that column of smoke for about 70 miles and found the ship, and there was nothing that we could do, really, when we got out there. The ship was burning. The previous crew had already lifted off whatever crew had survived, and there was a lot of fireboats and that kind of thing on scene. So we spent probably 4 or 5 hours that day just shuttling back and forth to the beach and pick up extra firefighters and firefighting foam and that kind of thing. And so then that was on Saturday. Probably by Monday, I think 3 more helicopters and a bunch of crews from various other Gulf Coast air stations arrived, and we kind of set up we only flew from sunrise to sunset, but during those hours, they put a 210, I think the Valiant was the on-scene commander, and so we would, between sunrise and sunset, about every 30 minutes, one of our helicopters would hit the flight deck of the Valiant, and just hauling people and logistics and food and water and whatever they needed. So they, you know, they had a regular schedule where they would, they'd call the air station and tell us to bring stuff, and we'd load it up and bring it out there. So we made, I want to say we did about 15 sorties a day for 3 weeks, just hauling stuff back and forth to them. But the funniest story was at the very end, Valiant had been on scene for 3 weeks or something, and they were tired, and our guys were tired. And so the Valiant CO called our air station CO, Captain White, and said, I want to give my guys pizza. If I order Domino's, will you guys deliver? And Captain White said, of course we will. So I happened to have the duty that night. So he called Domino's and ordered 100 pizzas for his crew. The Domino's guy had no idea what was going on. You know, he drove to the air station with a car full of pizza, and he got there. We were sitting out on the ramp with a rotor turning already, so he figured out pretty fast what was going on. And he gave us all the boxes, and he gave us the little red warming things that they go in. And for the last thing, he took the sign off the top of his car. He gave it to us, and we stuck it in the chin bubble of the helicopter. So we flew out to the Valiant. These guys, they were tired, you know. I mean, they've been offloading stuff for 3 weeks, every hour or something like that. And so they cleared us to land. We taxied in. We cleared the edge of the flight deck. You could see the guys in the flight deck crew, just they saw the Domino's sign in the window and they figured it out. So we landed and opened the door and they started offloading pizzas. It was the one of the funniest stories of my whole career. I think about that all the time. What a great thing it was. You know, just the camaraderie of the Coast Guard is what a wonderful thing.